Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Barkley in Washington. Today is Wednesday, September 6th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Amnesty International says Eritrean defense forces committed war crimes in Ethiopia's Tigray region.
We have found evidence that women were subjected to gang rape and sexual slavery in one of the locations, Kokod Zamaha. And also we found out evidence that they were also denied of getting access to medical care.
Zimbabwe authorities arrest two human rights lawyers. Guinea's military junta celebrates second year in power amid opposition calls for protest. Ugandan police say they have recovered in 2 days six improvised bombs in Kampala. Nigeria's government says it and the Trade Union Congress have agreed there should be no strike action for the next 2 weeks.
I told them that Mr. President has started implementing some of these issues. After the explanations, they all accepted that they were not going to go on strike. And they will wait for the next 2 weeks to see what efforts we are going to do to address some of these issues.
And non-local teachers in Kenya's predominantly Muslim region demand transfers. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Amnesty International says Eritrean Defense Forces, the EDF, committed war crimes and possibly crimes against humanity in Ethiopia's Tigray region. This, despite a peace agreement calling for the cessation of hostilities. In a new report released September 5, Amnesty says the EDF extrajudicially executed civilians and sexually enslaved women for months after the signing of the peace agreement in South Africa. Haimanot Ashanafi is the Horn of Africa researcher for Amnesty International. She tells me that Eritrea and Ethiopia must investigate these alleged crimes and prosecute under international laws where necessary.
In this research, we interviewed victims, survivors, eyewitnesses and family members in two different locations in Tigray region of Ethiopia. These crimes, that are crimes under international law, has happened before the cessation of the hostilities agreement, as the peace talk was happening in Pretoria, South Africa, and up to 3 months after the signing of the peace deal. We have found evidence that women were subjected to rape, gang rape, and sexual slavery in one of the locations, Kokod Zamaha. And also we found out evidence that they were also denied of getting access to comprehensive medical care, including emergency post-rape care. We also found out that Eritrean soldiers extrajudicially executed civilians in both Mariam Shewito and Kokod Zamaha. We have a feeling that these crimes might still be ongoing in parts of Tigray region that are still under Eritrean Defense Forces control.
So what time did you conduct this report? Did you travel there to the Tigray region? And because as you mentioned, there was an agreement now, a peace agreement underway. So what period did you cover?
The period is from October 2022, end of October, to be specific, since the 25th of October up until end of January, to be specific again, until the 19th of January. This is the time frame we covered.
Is it possible that these crimes you mentioned no longer exist, or they are still going on?
Well, that is the narrative that we should tackle. This peace agreement or the cessation of hostilities agreement happened in November 2022. That is a few months ago. And I mean, as a result of this peace deal, we have seen a significant development in terms of an end to active fighting in the region, a relatively better flow of humanitarian goods and services and other, you know, basic services for civilians living in Tigray. However, as we demonstrated in the research, this peace deal is not necessarily an end to the gross human rights violations in Tigray. Violations persisted, and we're saying this with an overwhelming amount of evidence.
Did you share this or make any contact with the Ethiopian government in terms of the findings of your study?
Yes, so that is mandatory practice within AI, within Amnesty International, and we shared our findings 2 weeks before the report was published with both the Eritrean and the Ethiopian government officials. We have not received any responses.
What do you hope to come out of this report?
We believe that without a proper justice and accountability efforts in Ethiopia, human rights violations are going to reoccur and resurface. And I think that is where our worry comes. But looking at the larger picture, if the international community decides to, you know, let Ethiopia and Eritrean government get away with these huge, huge, huge crimes, if there is no accountability, this will reemerge and reoccur, and we have no guarantee of non-recurrence. So to achieve that, one of the steps towards justice and accountability should be renewing the mandate of ICHREE. ICHREE is an independent investigative commission appointed by the United Nations Human Rights Council. Its mandate will expire in December. So we are calling for the UNHRC to renew the mandate of this investigative commission to continue its work in Tigray and broadly in Ethiopia.
Aimanat Ashanafi is the Horn of Africa researcher for Amnesty International. She was speaking with me from Nairobi, Kenya. Rights groups in Zimbabwe say they are concerned about the arrest of two human rights lawyers who had asked police not to interview hospitalized opposition activists who say they were abducted and tortured. Columbus Mavunga reports from Harare, where rights groups want charges dropped against the lawyers.
Zimbabwe Lawyers for Human Rights members Douglas Coulthard and Tapiwa Muchilerepe arriving at Harare Magistrate Court. They were arrested Monday night after they had asked the police not to interview their two clients who are in hospital. The clients, Umberaishe Nende and Sonene Mukulshani of Citizens Coalition for Change, say they are victims of abduction, torture and drugging on Saturday by suspected state agents. Jeremiah Bamu of Zimbabwe Lawyers for Human Rights secured their release on $100 bail each.
What we basically placed before the court are complaints that their arrest amounts to a criminalization of the exercise of their profession. They were in the process of carrying out their duties, and all they did was to convey advice that they had received from medical personnel about the medical condition of their clients and their ability to extend for these interviews. And because of that simple conveyance of information and representation of their clients, they've been arrested and are now placed in command. That is a direct attack on the independence of the legal profession, and is a move that is calculated in making lawyers fail to exercise their functions.
He says Coulthard and Muchilerepe are expected back in court on August 20 to determine the legality of the charges against them for obstructing or defeating the course of justice. Lucia Masuka, the executive director of Amnesty International in Zimbabwe, says nobody should be prosecuted simply for exercising their human rights, including the right to represent the arrested.
Everyone, regardless of their political affiliation, should be able to freely participate in peaceful activism without fear of abduction or harm. The Zimbabwean authorities must immediately stop issuing inflammatory statements that could incite attacks against political activists, human rights defenders, and other people. The authorities must also ensure a peaceful post-election environment by fully respecting, protecting, and ensuring the rights to freedom of peaceful assembly, association, and expression.
A repeated efforts to get a comment from Kazembe Kazembe, Zimbabwe's Home Affairs Minister, were fruitless Tuesday as he did not answer his calls. The arrest of the two lawyers happened the day President Emmerson Mnangagwa was sworn in for his second term and vowed to respect the Constitution.
Under my leadership and the new ZANU-PF government, democracy, good governance, the rule of law, and the politics of tolerance will be entrenched in line with the spirit and letter of our sacred national constitution and laws.
Intolerance and not observing the rule of law is something the Zimbabwe government has been accused of since 1980, when the country got its independence. Columbus Mavunga, VOA News, Harare, Zimbabwe.
Nigeria's Minister of Labour and Employment says government and the Trade Union Congress have agreed that there should be no strike action for the next 2 weeks while the government works on addressing workers' grievances. The Trade Union Congress and Labour Congress have been holding nationwide protests over the suspension of fuel subsidy and are demanding a new minimum wage for civil servants. This week, they called for a two-day warning strike. Minister of Labor and Employment Solomon Lalong says the government met with representatives of the Trade Union Congress on Tuesday, and the union agreed to give the government 2 weeks to address some of their complaints.
When we heard of the notice, we quickly invited them to a meeting yesterday, which all of them agreed they were coming for a meeting. But eventually, only the Trade Union Congress turned out. So we had a meeting with the Trade Union Congress. And all the issues that were raised were the same. It was all about having a meeting with the president before the swearing-in of the cabinet members. And of course, we informed them that, yes, we are just running. The cabinet members are already taking briefs from their ministries, including the Ministry for Labor and Employment.
Minister, you mentioned the issues, Labor Congress and the trade unions. They have been talking about wage awards for federal civil servants.
Yes.
So what did you tell them, what assurance did you give them that these issues will, the government will handle these?
Well, to them, the wage awards were even mentioned by Mr. President himself. But I told them that Mr. President has started implementing some of these issues. The issue of the palliatives, part of it, they are already sending money to the states and the local governments. So you wait for Mr. President to handle this one, because some of those issues that were not handled, as I said, were because the cabinet was not there. The cabinet was just done about 2 weeks or so. So part of it was already done. And to wait and see the commitment of Mr. President, we are here. And that's what we are discussing, to brief Mr. President, and then Mr. President will now tell us how we go about addressing all these issues immediately.
Did you get any commitment that the Trade Union Congress or so, that they will not strike again until the issues are taken care of?
No. For the Trade Union Congress, after the explanations, they all accepted that they were not going to go on strike. And they will wait for the next 2 weeks to see what efforts we are going to do to address some of these issues.
Yeah, when I spoke to someone, I think it was early this week, I think one of the things they mentioned to me was that the federal government hasn't shown any commitment in the past. So what can you tell that person in terms of commitment?
No, it's not true. It is not true that the federal government has not shown any commitment. I think among those of these palliatives, and it's not something that you do in a day. The palliatives will take efforts. Some of them will even require the approval of the Federal Executive Council. National Economic Council comprises of the president or the vice president presiding. You will have to take it to them. Governors will have to agree for implementation, just like the 5 billion issues that were raised. Those ones require the commitment and also the approval of both the federal government and the governors.
Solomon Lalong is Nigeria's Minister of Labor and Employment. He was speaking with me from the capital, Abuja. You are listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Barty in Washington. Today is Wednesday, September 6th. For more Africa news and features, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Connect with us on all social media platforms. We are on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. As Guinea's military junta celebrated 2 years in power yesterday, Tuesday, opposition and pressure groups called for protest, but the junta banned all demonstrations the night before. Throughout Monday night until Tuesday afternoon, security forces and angry youths in opposition strongholds were fighting battles. Reporter Karim Kamara in the capital, Conakry, has more on the story.
2 years after the coup, the military says it has accomplished a lot and describes its time in power as largely positive. but the opposition says the junta's record is worse than any other regime in Guinea. It accuses the military government of widespread corruption and poor governance. Dr. Edward Zotomo is a member of the opposition.
These guys are not here to do projects. What they're here to do is just to try to fool people into getting them to believe that they are here really for the goodness of those people. In fact, from the rumors, the cost of these projects that they're supposed to be doing is mind-boggling. People who, from what we understand, barely making $300, $350 a month, if you see, you hear that they are raising buildings that are 12 stories, where are they getting the money from? That's why we don't think they're not there for the people. They're there for themselves.
The opposition and other pressure groups called on their supporters to hold a peaceful demonstration Tuesday to show their anger. But on Monday, the government issued a communique reiterating their ban on demonstrations. Monday evening, hungry youth in opposition strongholds on the outskirts of Conakry mounted barricades and burned tires on the roads. Security forces were then called in. According to Balaya Jallo, the spokesperson for Guinean non-governmental organizations or Mouvement Social, death and injuries were recorded. He says Monday night at midnight, he called his source who told him that two people were killed. And on Tuesday morning, he says, was told that there was a third victim. The government has not yet confirmed the death. He says this is the situation in which they are living. There were no vehicles on the streets of opposition strongholds on the outskirts of Conakry on Tuesday, and shops, stores, and other business centers remain closed. Well-armed security personnel were deployed in strategic areas in the opposition areas. Intermittent gunshots could be heard in the distance. Political analyst Fahim Bamara says the solution to the political crisis in Guinea lies with the junta.
He says in a situation like this, as long as the protagonists do not agree on a timetable for a transition to civilian rule, there are nothing to talk about. He says things can start only after the main actors have met and agreed on how to run the transition. Without that, there is no consensus and you cannot talk about the beginning of a way forward.
Disagreements between the junta and the opposition are deepening day by day. The opposition says before talks can begin, their key leaders and previous prime ministers accused by the military of embezzlement of state funds must return home. The junta, for its part, says new elections will require $600 million supplied for the most part by foreign donors. Reporting for VOA Africa, I am Karim Kamara in Conakry.
Ugandan police say they have recovered 6 improvised bombs in Kampala in 2 days. Police spokesperson Fred Nanga said in a press release that a threat still exists and that the police have taken measures to mitigate all forms of terror. This discovery comes a few days after a man attempted to enter a church with a bomb in his bag. The U.S. Embassy has recently issued a warning about security concerns in Uganda, citing crime, terrorism, and anti-LGBTQ issues. Charles Wanguya Mpagi is a political analyst and TV host. He tells VOA's Douglas Mponga that although the terrorism threat should be taken seriously, creating fear and panic among the population works in a terrorist favor.
Uganda has suffered quite a number of insecurities over a long period of time, and placing of explosives has been common, if you can put it, to about the last 20 plus years. It's about 2001. So in a country that has suffered a series of attacks, any threat should be taken seriously. And this particular one should be taken seriously.
The police point a finger at the rebel group ADF. Do they have conclusive evidence, or it's just because it has been the one that has carried out attacks before?
The ADF has been the foil guy for every threat of insecurity in this city and in the country for the last many years, especially where the insecurity is caused by throwing of explosives or placement of explosives. So it's natural that the first finger would point to ADF, but you want to believe that maybe the security has its intelligence right. They made an arrest already in respect to this to the threat at the church. And what basis would there be to doubt? The other group that would be suspected would have been the Al-Shabaab that did detonate explosives at World Cup venues in 2010. That's more than a decade ago. So the ADF is the one that has been active in this region, both from their bases in the Democratic Republic of Congo and with operating cells within the country.
The American embassy in Kampala has issued a travel alert, and the police is advising people to avoid crowded places. How seriously should people take this threat?
Well, this hasn't the latest round of threats. So the security says that they have picked up a number of explosives or potential IEDs. Terrorism wins where the people get scared. So as much as people should take this seriously, creating a sense of fear among the population can hasten and increase what otherwise the security should be able to contain.
That was Charles Mwanguya Mpagi, a political analyst and TV host. He was speaking from Kampala with Douglas Mpuga. An education crisis is once again looming in Kenya as hundreds of non-local teachers demand transfers from the predominantly Muslim region in the country's northeast after a series of deadly attacks by Al-Shabaab militants. Schools reopened August 28, but most students have not yet resumed classes. Ahmed Hussein reports from Wajir County in Kenya.
Here in Konton at a primary school in Kenya's Wajir County, teacher Ibrahim Hassan begins work. Hassan has volunteered to teach after most of the teachers left because of the recent attacks in the area by the Islamist militant group Al-Shabaab. He says the school turned some of the pupils away.
Since the students are many and we are so less, we can't teach it. Sometimes you send some children at the home.
Since 2014, more than 4,000 teachers have fled schools from the northeastern region due to insecurity. Al-Shabaab has killed 16 people in the region in the past 2 months, including 2 non-local teachers, and it has injured upwards of a dozen others. Many schools near the Somalia border, badly hit by the exodus, are on the brink of closure. Wajir County residents say the need is too great.
5 among the youth have volunteered themselves to take part in the teaching. We should continue teaching because of this, and the children who will become the leaders of tomorrow.
Over the past week, hundreds of teachers have been camping outside the office of the Teachers Service Commission, or TSC, in Nairobi, seeking transfer from the region.
We did an oath.
We took an oath to work in every part of the country, but you cannot work in a place where death is waiting for you.
That's power! Power!
Drawn from Mandera, Wajir, and Garissa counties in the northeast, the teachers said they were not returning to duty until the employer moved them from the region.
We've been affected by a lack of security in our workplace. As you know, one of our colleagues was killed, and after we asked to be transferred, those responsible have turned down our request.
Last year, the Teachers Service Commission contracted most of the affected teachers who are required to work in the area for 3 to 5 years before seeking transfer. Schools reopened for the third time on August 28th, but most of students in Kenya's northeast have not resumed classes because of the teacher exodus. Experts warn that the exodus could bring learning in the region to a complete halt and are asking the government to train more teachers.
One of the challenges the region faces is it's not able to attract a good number of high school leavers with the right grades to join teaching. So the general belief is that if the teaching grade is lowered to like C-, it might attract numbers.
The region has a history of violence involving teachers. 17 teachers died in 2014 after a bus they were traveling in was attacked while heading to Nairobi for the December holidays. In January 2020, TSC transferred tutors from northeastern Kenya to other parts of the country, citing insecurity, after 3 of them were killed by Al-Shabaab during a night raid. Many parents from Kenya's northeastern region are hopeful a lasting solution will be found soon so the children can get access to quality education like the rest of the students in the country. I'm Hussein for VOA News, Wajir, Kenya.
And that's it for this Wednesday, September 6th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for coming aboard with us this morning. For more Africa news and features, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Connect with us on all social media platforms. We are on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. We are also on YouTube, where you can watch our TV shows, Africa 54, Straight Talk Africa, and Red Carpet. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, I am James Barton in Washington, wishing that you will have a lovely day.